at 7-Eleven on WGN. John Hanson here, and thrilled to be here till 8 o'clock. The Mincing Rascals take over then. Part of that podcast up till Blackhawks pregame at 8:30 with Charlie Romiliotis. Okay, I teed this up in the tease, but the Ten Commandments appear not to be, at least for the moment, mandated to go up in Louisiana anymore at the public schools. It got me thinking broadly about the First Amendment and religion and separation of church and state, and really wanting to kind of deconstruct where that all came from, why it is what it is, and where we go from here. For that, I was recommended to talk to Alan Brownstein. He's the UC Davis Professor Emeritus, and he has quite a resume. He's clerked for United States Court of Appeals judges, and he's a scholar in the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment, which deals with religion. So first, I wanted to just get from him a deconstructed look at why religion is really in the First Amendment to begin with.
Well, I mean, religion was very, very important to the people of the colonies. Even then, it was a relatively diverse religious population. Now, when I say religiously diverse, I mean religiously diverse within the Protestant faith, because there were very, very, very few Jews, very few Catholics, and regrettably, Native American beliefs and faith simply didn't count. They weren't viewed as legitimate religious practice. But there was enough diversity within the Protestant faith that there was concern about government interfering with religion. That's the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. And also concern about the government promoting religion. And certainly the colonists' experience with England had not been a favorable one, where there was an established church and ecclesiastical hierarchy. And the colonists very much resented the idea that this British faith should be dominant in the colonies. And then they carried beyond that to the idea that, well, no faith should be dominant. The commitment ultimately was to voluntarism, to the recognition that government does religion badly. When government involves itself with religion, bad things happen. We're much better off, as is true with free speech, we're much better off if we just trust the people to make voluntary private sector decisions about whether they should be religious. And if they are adherents of a particular faith, they get to choose which faith they should accept. And the government shouldn't be putting its heavy hand in favor of one particular religion or another. So in a kind of easy way to think about it is, government shouldn't interfere with religion. Government shouldn't promote religion. Protect, but do not engage in preferentialism.
Some people have tried to argue in the past that, yes, maybe the framers wanted a separation of church or state, but certainly government can kind of talk about the religion that they have, that they love, that they maybe prefer. But I think that the fact that, as you've noted, they really put it in the Constitution in a way that made it clear that it wasn't just we won't prefer one over the other, but that the government itself would not establish one. I mean, that was done with intent, I'd imagine you'd argue.
I think it was. Now, you know, to be fair, these are complicated constitutional mandates. And if you took a poll of American colonists, you'd get a lot of different answers as to what they thought the Free Exercise Clause required, what constituted a prohibited establishment of religion. It varied among faiths, it varied among colonies. But ultimately, I think we need to move beyond that, because we have 230 years, constitutional change and demographic change. The time of the framing of the Constitution, the colony was overwhelmingly Protestant. Now we have millions of Catholics, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, people who are members of faiths that didn't exist back then, like the Church of Latter-day Saints, plus millions upon millions of people who are not religious. That demographic change needs to be taken into account, and also constitutional change. As you know, the 14th Amendment includes an equal protection clause, and that commits our constitutional system to norms of equality that may not have been on people's minds in 1789. But once you have a case like Brown versus Board of Education, which says even when things are materially equal, government can act in ways that demeans and undermines the status of particular groups, and that's constitutionally problematic. But this idea that government shouldn't be picking favorites, shouldn't be setting up a hierarchy of status, of races or religions, that's become an important driving force.
That is Professor Alan Brownstein. We're just getting started with the UC Davis Professor Emeritus. We'll take that foundational setup for the First Amendment. We'll take it further to school prayer, the Ten Commandments, and more. After this on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association on WGN. Before the break, UC Davis Professor Emeritus Alan Brownstein about how religion ended up in the Constitution. Now we pivot to where it often meets tension, and that's in the schools.
There has. In fact, if you're as old as I am, I can remember when I was a child in elementary schools where we were directed to recite the Regent's Prayer, a prayer that was ultimately struck down as unconstitutional by the United States Supreme Court. I think it was around 1962. That's an interesting case to look at just as for the foundation of the court's jurisprudence with regard to protecting the religious rights of school children, because in theory, this was a voluntary prayer. No one was required to recite it. But as I often tell people, I remember the prayer. I could recite it to you right now. And I remember when it was declared unconstitutional. I don't remember anyone ever telling me it was voluntary. I didn't know that was a voluntary prayer until my second year of law school, when I read Engle versus Vitale. And the Supreme Court said, oh, this is a voluntary prayer. And I said, what? Not where I went to school. And indeed, you can't have things like voluntary prayers in the public school system. Because when a teacher has the kind of discretionary authority and principals have the kind of discretionary authority that they do over the lives of students, then when they invite you to voluntarily participate in a religious exercise, in my view, that's intrinsically coercive. The children have every reason to feel that if they don't participate, the teacher or the principal will hold that against them.
Or by other peers, right? If 90% of your class is reciting it, there is a sense that I don't belong if I don't do it too.
There's no question that peer pressure exists. The legal significance of peer pressure has been disputed. Some justices, like Justice Kennedy, thought that peer pressure was relevant. Other justices, like Justice Scalia, disagreed and said it has to be government that's sanctioning you, that's putting pressure on you. Other private individuals are imposing peer pressure and criticizing your decision. That has no constitutional significance. So that's been a disputed issue.
Yeah, and this is, I think, at the crux of why constitutional law as a whole is so fascinating and hard all at once, because I often oscillate between two different opinions that justices make, great arguments on both sides, and I think that's what makes the study of it so engaging and fun, is that I could read one opinion, and then I could feel like, oh, yeah, I'm nodding along to that. And then I read the other side and I go, wait, hold on, I'm agreeing with that too.
that's a good attitude to have, because a lot of these cases are difficult cases in the sense that there are things of value on both sides. The tough cases, the controversial cases, often involve costs, benefits that exist on both sides, and that makes them difficult. On the other hand, one of the best ways to think about some of these issues is to put yourself in the shoes of the other side. So, you know, if you're thinking, well, what's wrong with having religious text posted in a classroom? The question you want to ask is, suppose it's not your religious text. Suppose it's a religious text that's directly inconsistent with what you're teaching your children to believe. Are you as comfortable with having that religious text posted in a classroom as you would be if it was a text that was fully consistent with your own religious beliefs or the beliefs of the majority? It's sometimes argued that while school prayer is clearly unconstitutional because it's directly coercive, you're telling children to get up and to recite a prayer, something like the posting of the Ten Commandments is less problematic because it's passive. Nobody is required to do anything in response to the posting of the Ten Commandments, in response to seeing them there on the wall of the classroom. And there are really three responses to that. One response is, well, but the children have to be there.
Right. They're mandated to be there.
School attendance.
Right.
So they're coerced into having to view religious scripture that might be inconsistent with their beliefs. Second, and the court said this in Engel versus Vitale, that when the government puts its power and prestige behind a particular religious belief, well, that is intrinsically coercive. You know, that sends a message to religious minorities. Their views, their beliefs are second best. And then related to that, you know, the third issue is, well, the government is assigning preferential status to certain religious beliefs over others. And this is more of an equality concern than a liberty concern. It focuses less on coercion and more on, are we treating people equally, with equal respect, as if they are of equal worth? And to say that the beliefs of only one faith get posted on a public classroom wall and no other faiths are recognized or receive comparable treatment, that certainly seems to send a message that the government prefers one religion over another. It's endorsing one religion over another. And to the extent that you believe in equality of status, that the government should treat people of different faiths just like it treats people of different races, as if they are of equal worth and deserving of equal respect, then you don't do that. Now, one response to that argument is, well, you're secularizing society.
Yeah.
You know, you're excluding religion from the public sector. Doesn't that privilege secular beliefs and ideas? And it would, if we only had one clause in the Constitution, the Establishment Clause. But we don't. We have two, the Free Exercise Clause as well. And the Free Exercise Clause only protects religion. So what we have here is this complex, almost rough justice quid pro quo, where religion is favored with regard to its freedom from regulatory interference under the Free Exercise Clause, but it's disfavored with regard to the government's ability to promote it under the Establishment Clause. If you put them together, you've got a fair argument that religion is being treated fairly and appropriately. The government can't interfere and can't promote.
Yeah, I find that all fascinating. And I love when you argue against yourself and your points. That is fascinating to watch you present both sides, Professor. As to the Ten Commandments, right, and this, especially with this Louisiana law, the fact that it is a mandated thing, it wasn't one school district that organically decided to celebrate the different origins of religion in the world and do a wall map for a history class showing, here's the Quran, here's how this was established, here's the Ten Commandments, here's some other ones too. Are there any other students that want to participate and suggest theirs? I think that would, or anyone that's not participating, please have some representation of that. I think that is where we would see a much more favorable outcome towards the school system. Or, for instance, the library has a Bible in it. It also has the Quran. It also has Scientology. That's a study area within the school where his, you know, pursuit of academia is taken on. And I could see arguments for why those books would be allowed as long as all books were allowed. But this is why this is hard.
Nobody thinks the library endorses every book that's on the shelves.
Right.
A lot of books are inconsistent with each other. All that the library says is that this is a book that some people might find to be worth reading. When you have to make choices as to what you will endorse and promote, that's where constitutional concerns come into play. I could imagine a park that had a Ten Commandments, a cross, a Star of David, icons of other faiths. In fact, one of the government systems that I think does religion really well is the Department of Veterans Affairs, because you're buried in a national cemetery and the government provides you a headstone. You get to choose a belief icon to put on your stone. And the icons of choice aren't simply a cross or a cross and a Star of David. There are, I think, over 80 or 90 different icons reflecting all the different faiths of the United States. And there's an atheist icon. So, you know, the Department of Veterans Affairs says it's not our job to promote a particular faith. What it's our job to do is to respect people of different faiths who sacrificed for their country. And as sacrifices were all equal, and we want to be equally respectful of all of them.
We'll have more with Professor Alan Brownstein and the First Amendment and its role in religion. We'll even talk about a local case that was decided at the Supreme Court recently. We'll do that after we get Ron Brown's news here on 720 WGN. Every now and then I get real constitutional, and I just want to dive deep into why the laws in this country are the way that they are. We were talking about the First Amendment and religion and the protection of it and the fact that the government stays out of it. And Professor Alan Brownstein is the one who has been breaking down the history of it, why we have it, and some of the cases that it deals with in the schools. We started talking about it, and I remembered that, oh yeah, there was a Supreme Court case featuring a situation right here in the Chicagoland area of a coach in who wanted to, Joe Kennedy, a football coach, who had been suspended from his job in 2015 over post-game prayers at the 50-yard line. And wanted to ask the professor about his take on that and a couple other cases.
Now, the facts of that case were very convoluted. One point, the coach was leading students in prayer in the locker room. And he stopped doing that. People said, that's unacceptable. So finally he said, when the game is over and I no longer really have a lot of coach responsibilities, I want to go out in the middle of the field and say a prayer. And yeah, and nobody is required to come with me. Some people argued it's still intrinsically coercive because the coach determines playing time, which is what everybody on a team wants. And you might think, well, he hasn't required me to participate in his prayer. He hasn't even invited me. But if I join him, he may look favorably on me, and I won't be warming the bench as much as some other player who didn't participate in this religious exercise. I thought there was intrinsic coercion there. I thought the court got it wrong. But again, the facts were very convoluted, and it was really hard to get a clear picture of what was going on. I think a coach in a locker room or a teacher in a classroom, that is much more clearly unconstitutional under accepted precedent.
I love that I brought up an example down the street from me, and I didn't know all the details, and you're in California, and you knew it. Do you have a Google alert set for any religious court case?
Well, if it goes to the United States Supreme Court, I'm certainly going to read it.
Yeah,
I want to be really clear here that arguments I'm describing about striking down the posting of the Ten Commandments, which, by the way, the district court had to do because it was a Supreme Court case on point in 1980, it said this is unconstitutional. This court had no discretion.
Right.
It's not his or her job to overrule prior Supreme Court precedent. But I think it's a mistake to view Establishment Clause constraints on government promotion of religion as hostility towards religion. Because, again, you can take the position that I do, which is I want a rigorously enforced Establishment Clause limiting the government's ability to promote religion and to prefer some faiths over others. But I also want a very rigorously enforced free exercise clause, which clearly provides a lot of benefits to religions that aren't available to their secular counterparts. So there are a lot of people who want a strong free exercise clause and no establishment clause. A lot of people who want a rigorously enforced establishment clause, but they couldn't care less about free exercise. But there are people like me who say, you know, we got two clauses in the First Amendment, and there's a reason for that. And actually, when you put them together, they mutually reinforce each other. And you have what we call the separation of church and state, which essentially means government has to keep its distance from religion. And if you can't interfere with religion and you can't promote religion, well, you got to keep some distance from religion.
I was entering the same struggle in my head when we had the campuses protesting, so many of them across the country, and some universities chose to strictly enforce their rules. Some others allowed time to pass before they would clear areas from, and I was in my head arguing back and forth and ultimately decided that the state should be uniformly holding the law the same way no matter who it is, whether it's speech that we like or not. And that, in fact, even though it may seem harsh to clear off campuses for people that aren't violent or anything along those lines, they were still prohibiting free access to classrooms, et cetera, that if you don't enforce that, that shows government favor in a way, and that weakens the First Amendment on the whole. That, in fact, strict enforcement of this makes it better and more clear for all of us to let our voices be heard.
I mean, I think that's right. If you have legitimate time, place, and manner regulations, regulations prohibiting encampments, or legitimate time, place, and manner regulations, regulations prohibiting obstruction to buildings, again, legitimate time, place, and manner regulation, those have to be applied uniformly, both for theoretical and for practical reasons. The theoretical reason is if you bend the rules for one group as opposed to another, because you like the positions of that group, that's viewpoint discrimination. And that is the worst kind of government regulation of speech. The courts will uphold time, place, and manner regulations. They will almost never uphold viewpoint discriminatory regulations. The other problem with bending the rules on occasion, and here I have some sympathy for administrators because they're caught in a tough place. Sometimes, if you bend the rules, a protest will, over an hour or two, dissipate. And it won't cause a significant problem for people for any significant period of time. And you might feel the best thing to do is to stay back and just let it run its course. Because if we rigorously enforce these speech regulations, we might exacerbate the situation. That might lead to violence, to other kinds of problematic activity. And I can understand that. I really understand why an administrator would say, let's just wait a couple of hours and let this taper out. The problem is, once you do that for one group, you got to do it for all groups.
Yep.
And eventually, the time, place, and manner regulation loses its force across the board. So one question I've often asked protesters who want to obstruct buildings, I say, if that's legitimate, is it also legitimate to obstruct access to a student health clinic that provides abortion services? Because it's got to be the same rule for both.
Yep.
And they don't want to hear that argument because they are very opposed to obstructing access to clinics providing abortion services, but they think they should have the right to obstruct access to a library or a classroom or an administrative building because their cause is just. But for First Amendment purposes, all causes are equally just or unjust. It's not the government's business to pick and choose.
I feel like I'm back in office hours 20 years ago for my First Amendment class with my wonderful professor at the University of Illinois, Steve Helley. I'll leave you. I just got one last question for you, Professor.
Sure.
Just this is a look back at the First Amendment as a whole. You mentioned that, you know, they established the Establishment Clause and the other clause as well. They just worked perfect harmony. This was at a time when, while we had religious diversity, it was mainly within the Protestant faith. That part of the First Amendment has held so strong, even with the introduction of so many new religions in a more diverse society. In many ways, how I feel like freedom of the press or just the freedom of speech in general has held from when we were doing newspaper or newsletters to the internet. It's a really amazingly well-crafted amendment that has stood the test of time in so many ways. And not to get too weepy-eye about it, but it is one of those things that makes me really proud to live where I live.
Having rigorously enforced religion clauses has been instrumental to the development of religious freedom and equality in the United States. What it's done is allowed members of minority faiths to live anywhere in the United States. Not to feel like I have to live in a community where there are enough people like me so I can protect myself politically. Instead, you know, the Bill of Rights is like a turtle shell. We carry it with us wherever we go. And that means I could go to a state or a city where there are very few Jews and feel like, but I'm still going to be protected with regard to my right to worship. And I send my children to public schools, and they won't be treated as second-class citizens because they're not members of the majority faith. The virtue of that is incalculable, because once people of different faiths live and work together, they see that, you know, the fact that somebody worships a little bit differently than I do, that doesn't mean they're not a good person. They work in a factory or in a service line with me, and they do their job just as well as I do. They contribute to charities. They do all the things that everyone else does. Because once you live and work with people who are different than you are, you realize, you know, in most ways, they're pretty much the same.
It's a really interesting conversation with Professor Emeritus Alan Brownstein from UC Davis. I appreciate him joining me. I love that the Bill of Rights is like a turtle shell that we carry with us wherever we go. Oh, boy, that was interesting. Yeah, you know, these things are often in conflict, right? The religious aspects of our country. Obviously, so many Judeo-Christian things were brought in to the Constitution and the ideas of it, but the fact that they explicitly laid out that the government shall not establish a religion, but also the government shall not infringe on religion, I think was a rather brilliant thing that the founding fathers of our country put together. Some people have thrown two things at me on the text line to maybe counter the idea that the government shall not establish a religion. And the two of them are both interesting. I've heard a lot of these things before. The first one is, yes, but all of our elected politicians and officials say, so help me God, at the end of an oath. That's part of the oath that the president has to take, so help me God. And I would counter that, in fact, that is not the oath of office for the president of the United States. Then nowhere of the oath in the Constitution does it say, so help me God. That is something that George Washington mentioned himself at the end of the phrase of his first oath, and that set a precedent for future presidents and continues what was already established in his day. So no, the oath of the United States does not include, so help me God. And then people say, well, you swear on a Bible, but that is not, there's no obligation for that either. You could swear on anything or nothing. That is just the custom, not the requirement for taking oaths of office. Another point that people bring up is that, oh, but we say one nation under God in our Pledge of Allegiance. I think a lot more people know the history of that, and that is nowhere written down in the original founding documents. The Pledge of Allegiance did not include one nation under God. In fact, that was a phrase that the was it added in 1954. This is the post-Red Scare, post-fear of communism, et cetera, et cetera. That pledge was added under President Eisenhower, who felt that there were global threats that the country was facing. He was trying to unify the nation and reaffirm the country's Judeo-Christian heritage. But it's not in the founding set of the Pledge of Allegiance. There's a lot of tension as a pertains to religion in this country and its exercise of, and I just find the whole discussion fascinating. And as long as people are well-meaning and well-thought in their arguments and they bring them to the table, I certainly welcome those.